You're listening to Thought Huddle. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. This is a podcast produced by Arizona State University, and it's for audiences everywhere, not just those under the desert sun. We engage with fascinating people on a wide variety of subjects, people who are thinkers and doers and motivated by the desire to create meaningful impact. Thought Huddle explores ideas, tells stories, and hopefully makes some sense of our complicated and beautiful world.
Everything about her is adorable and amazing and sweet.
He's a lover boy, therefore he lives up to his name, Romeo. He's just a gentle boy.
My angel sent from above.
He's definitely the love of our lives. Oh, look at that face.
That, of course, is the sound of people talking about their dogs, and today's program is all about dogs. Full disclosure, I'm a total dog person. When I was in my 20s and lived in a city where I couldn't have my own dog, I spent so much time stopping people with dogs on the street that my friend called me, "Mary, can I pat your dog, Charlotte?" I have concluded through entirely unscientific studies that the majority of human beings on planet Earth are dog people. Of course, there are also cat people and people who just don't like any animals at all, but, well, let's not talk about them for now. Today, it's all about dogs and the people who love them and study them and work with them. There's been a huge surge of interest in dogs in the last generation or so, which has been really good, not only for our understanding of dogs, but for the dogs themselves. Before that, in this country, the American dog was maybe part of the storybook family, and people got dogs because they'd seen Lassie or 101 Dalmatians, and they often had no clue about these animals' natures or how to live with them. The idea that dogs are conscious, sentient beings, very much like us in some ways, but with specific and different needs, born of their wolf ancestry, that just really hadn't happened yet. When I think back on my childhood dog, a wonderful golden retriever named Taffy, I realize now that she spent so much time trying to communicate with me, with the whole family, and failing, which was really our failure to recognize even the most basic elements of doggy language and what dogs really needed. To this day, dogs are still not universally well-treated worldwide or in the U.S., but there has been progress. The American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals was founded in 1866, and a century later, the Animal Welfare Act was passed. Until the 1970s, shelters were euthanizing unwanted animals using methods like electrocution, clubbing, drowning, and carbon monoxide poisoning. But today, even though many animal shelters are struggling, they've become much more humane places, many of them offering not only animals for adoption, but also puppy and dog training classes, low-cost spay-neuter and veterinary care, and community education. So when we decided to do a Thought Huddle program about dogs, I made a big sign that said, "Tell me about your dog," and I went to sit in my local dog park. That's what you heard at the beginning, and we're going to hear some more of those stories today. And we're also going to hear from experts on dogs, including Gregor Larson, who studies dogs from ancient archaeological sites, Linda Milanesi from Assistance Dogs of the West, and Clive Wynn, a professor of psychology at Arizona State University who specializes in the minds of dogs, and who will be releasing a book later this year called Dog is Love. So let's start at the beginning. Dogs did not exist in the wild. They are entirely a product of interaction with human beings. From your little toy poodle to your Great Dane, dogs are descendants of the gray wolf, a great and mighty creature traveling across the plains tens of thousands of years ago when we were hunter-gatherers. But they didn't become dogs until they started living with us. And they were the first domestic species. Before we domesticated goats or cows or corn or wheat, we domesticated dogs. But the question of how dogs got domesticated is not fully understood, even by the world's foremost scientists studying this question. One of these scientists is the brilliant and fast-talking, as you'll hear, Gregor Larson. He's director of the Paleogenomics and Bioarchaeology Research Network at the School of Archaeology at the University of Oxford in England. which is a long title, but what it means is that he studies things like DNA from ancient dog remains, and he tries to piece together a picture of that human period that predated agriculture and cities. We talked via Skype, and I asked him how the human-dog relationship formed, how wolves came to live with us and become a new species.
That is a great question, and one that nobody really has a satisfactory answer to yet. I've got an idea in my head that I sort of think is more plausible. And what I think that is that wolves are very plastic behaviorally, and they can clearly exist in a lot of different ecological circumstances, and they adapt very readily to changing circumstances. So what I think may have been taking place is that there was a pack of wolves who, instead of perhaps following caribou or following something else, just started following people because they were able to take advantage of the resources that people provided. But then people were also getting more accustomed to having wolves around as well, and sort of recognized that there were certain advantages to having them around. And so if that's enough to get things going, what happens from there then is this an ever-closening relationship between people and wolves that then leads to dogs.
So that's a narrative, a plausible narrative, about the origin of dogs. What we know for sure is that a domestication process got going, and by 8,000 years ago, there are dogs buried in human cemeteries and in burial grounds, and they're being treated like members of the human community. Their poses show high status, and they're buried with objects that reflect the way people were burying one another. What that tells us is that dogs, even by 8,000 years ago, had integrated themselves into human communities and families and social networks in a way that mirrored the same kind of relationships that people had with each other. And the benefits of the dog-human relationship started piling up as dogs became valued workers.
It appears that there was certainly an added benefit to hunting with wolves, or dogs in this particular case, that would have meant that people were much more keen to have them around. And, you know, after that, then dogs clearly are capable of doing a whole range of different things. And it's that classic thing, you start taking advantage of an item for its initial benefit, and then you realize there's all these other things that it can do. And then it becomes a kind of Swiss Army knife of the domestic animal world, where you can then, now we use them in airports for sniffing out drugs, or we use them to tell people that a seizure is coming and are sniffing out cancer, or any number of other things that, of course, 8,000 years ago they weren't doing, but those are all sort of extra things that have been layered on top.
Next thing you know, it was the Roman Empire and there were lap dogs.
You don't really see very small dogs until the Roman era, when, again, it's about a job. They're either being used as bed warmers or as kind of a cultural style thing where you can have them around in the same way that you might put a small chihuahua in your handbag now. The Romans were using dogs from that perspective as well.
Still, for most of our history with dogs, they were valued mostly for their labor.
If there's a job to do around people and a dog has been good at it, you can bet that dogs have been doing it. So they can herd very well, they can retrieve, they can point, they can smell very well, they can breed them small, and then they can go after rabbits underground. So there's an element of the dog's behavioral repertoire that can be used by people in order to facilitate something that people want to do. You can bet somewhere in the world that there's a dog that, at least if it's not doing it now, did do it at some point in time. And clearly hunting is something that is carried through for a very long period of time. But also culturally, you can have dog fighting and bear baiting, and lots of people have been engaged in those kinds of activities, both in prehistory as all the way up to the present. It seems like there's no job too big or too small that a dog can't do, but nor is there a job that a dog is absolutely essential for that it can't just be eliminated once that job disappears as well.
So many of the details about dog evolution are still unknown. It's difficult to pinpoint when the wolf genetically became a dog, and that, says Larson, is because we aren't even really sure how to make that differentiation. What is a dog, and how is it different from a wolf? They can mate with each other and produce offspring, as we know from the many wolf hybrids that are still running around. But as dogs were domesticated, they did start to look different. There were black dogs and spotted dogs, which you never had in wolves. The oldest archaeological remains that seem to show a distinction between wolf and dog appear about 12,000 years ago, and it could be even earlier than that. But whatever the exact chronology, dogs were part of the transition from the hunter-gatherer world into the eras of agriculture and civilization. I asked Gregor Larson if the domestication of dogs helped us domesticate other animals and plants.
It's an interesting question, and I think what had changed was the way in which people probably perceive the natural world. And I suspect that, you know, a lot of our fairy tales are based around this dichotomy of the domestic animals and plants are the nice friendly things and everything else on the outside is the big bad wolf. And there wasn't really maybe such a thing as a big bad wolf until you had dogs, if you see what I mean. I tend to recoil at this suggestion that anything that people ever did was deliberate. We published some papers recently suggesting that, or demonstrating pretty clearly, that these canonical stories that people have made up around the origins of a lot of domestic animals are just that. They're just myths that we invent after the fact so that the people then start asking the question, why did we domesticate X? When in fact that implies an intentionality, I don't think what was there.
Another interesting and tricky question is, where were dogs first domesticated? Did it happen in one place and then spread? Or did it happen in multiple places simultaneously? Wolves ranged over the entire northern hemisphere for hundreds of thousands of years, and the oldest archaeological sites containing dog remains have been found in Europe, Central Asia, and East Asia. That suggests that maybe there were three lineages of dogs that evolved independently of one another. But scientists are still very much in the process of working out these questions. We do know that later, dogs came to what is now the American continent across the Bering Land Bridge with their humans. That was about 10,000 years ago, and new varieties of dogs evolved and established themselves. But then, when Europeans began to colonize the Americas roughly 500 years ago with their dogs, the resulting interactions of dogs was very much a mirror of the way humans interacted. In the same way that Europeans brought diseases that killed Native Americans who had no immunity to them, dogs suffered a similar devastation.
When the European dog showed up, they may have carried distemper or any number of other diseases that just on a wavefront knocked out a lot of the North American dogs. But there was certainly the same thing as humans. There were cultural reasons. There's mass murder on the part of Europeans when they get to North America. And there was likely mass killings or mass other kinds of persecution of local dogs or of simply being trendy. You know, you don't want the old dogs, you want the new dogs. And the new dogs were very good at doing lots of things in warfare that the older dogs probably weren't so good at. So these are all hypotheses to try and explain why those North American dogs vanished. I mean, we have the empirical evidence that demonstrates that there is virtually nothing left in dogs that are currently in North America from the ones that were there previously.
Now, if you're a science nerd, you may be wondering, how does science know all of this? How do you look at a bunch of ancient dog bones and gather meaning from them? We're actually at a pretty interesting moment right now because scientific research on dogs has been given a great boost by new technologies. Just in the same way that people are learning more about themselves through DNA testing, some of these really sophisticated DNA techniques have allowed scientists to paint a much more precise picture of dogs from existing remains. On top of that, a technique called geometric morphometrics allows researchers to take a snapshot of bones and teeth, either in two or three dimensions, and analyze them with a much greater level of resolution and accuracy than ever before.
A lot of these analyses are still very much in the preliminary stages. We've generated absolutely massive data sets from several different animals, including pigs and dogs. And a colleague of ours also has something like 3,500 rat teeth photographs. And so having data sizes that big, combined with these new ways of analyzing these data, means that we are now still wrestling a little bit with what that kind of means. We're doing that same analysis on several different elements with dogs. We have a couple of different teeth, we have mandibles, and we also have full skulls. And we can look at the changes in shape and in size in the skulls, which is a huge amount of information because it's also in three dimensions. And that gives us a lot more power. And those analyses are now underway, but we don't have anything yet that we're ready to tell any stories about.
So much remains to be discovered. But the one thing Larson knows for sure is this.
Every time we look at something that changed with people, the same thing changed with dogs. And so really, dogs are people and people are dogs. They're so inextricably linked that you have to expect that whatever pattern you see in one organism, you're going to see exactly the same thing in the other.
So dogs have been workers, really our co-workers, for a long time. For millennia and to this day, they hunt, garden herd livestock, pull sleds. Now they also sniff out drugs, bombs, and landmines, not to mention truffles. They are eyes for the blind, ears for the deaf. They do search and rescue. They help children read. They're therapists, soldiers, police, bedwarmers, entertainers, mascots, occasionally mousers. And all the while, they are our friends. I talked to Linda Milanesi, executive director of Assistance Dogs of the West, an organization that started out training dogs for people with disabilities and medical issues. I've met a number of these dogs, and they're amazingly calm, good dogs who do things like open cabinets and bring people things they need. They alert people with seizures, cancer, and diabetes. They form deep and trusting relationships with kids with autism. They calm people with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And recently, Assistance Dogs has been training people to do work in the criminal justice system.
Usually they work with special victims advocates.
And they're especially helpful to the most vulnerable people in the system.
What goes on when a crime is perpetrated? There's a forensic interview. This is where they're hoping that they get a deposition where the child or the elder or the person with a disability will actually tell what happened. These children usually are victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, just unspeakable crimes like you cannot imagine that an adult could perpetrate on a youngster. Looking at a dog at rest, you immediately feel safe. Nobody's ears are pricked up. Nobody has a little low growl. Nobody has a bark. All those things, when we don't have those indications from our dogs, we feel safe because they're our guardians. Lowers your blood pressure, lowers your cortisol levels, lowers your heart rate. So we're looking at our dogs and we're actually more relaxed than if we didn't have any canines. Also, it increases our oxytocin levels. And so that's the social bonding hormone. That's the mother and child. That's our feel-good hormone that increases. One of the dogs that worked in the Child Advocacy Center, he used to be able to be with the children. They would listen to Russell's heart rate, look in Russell's ears.
Russell the dog.
So that the child would start to be relaxed because if Russ can handle it, maybe they can handle it. We teach them all kinds of games to do with the dogs so that it helps with emotional regulation. It helps with breathing so that when the child actually has to take the stand, they're going to be a lot more relaxed. I've been in many, many of the courtrooms, and I can tell you, if I was a five-year-old child and you open up those big doors and you walk into a jury courtroom, it's incredibly intimidating. The jury is informed that there's a dog in the room, but you would never know because the dogs are trained to lay in the box. They're trained to be underneath the child's legs if need be. The kids love to have the dogs lay at their feet and they rub their feet on the dogs. And so the dogs are really fluent with that kind of behavior. They don't go like, oh, what are you doing? They're like, my kid is like rubbing me with their feet. One of the executive directors from a child advocacy center, she wrote me a letter when we first placed the dog there. And she said, what would take my highly skilled and highly trained staff 2 hours, Russell can accomplish in 10 to 15 minutes. And that's a courthouse facility dog helping children testify in the investigation and prosecution of crime. There was one child who was 15 years old and couldn't speak because of what had happened to them as a child. And being with the dog, she was finally able to testify. She had been sexually assaulted for like 9 years.
Did they get more convictions because of the dogs?
For sure, yes.
These assistance dogs have been sent to help at the site of school shootings, and they were deployed to the Las Vegas shooting in 2016.
They worked in the Family Assistance Center. They were in intensive care unit. They were in the hospitals. 500 people were shot. So you can imagine what the handlers and the dogs, like, this is day in, day out, really, really hard stuff. One of the handlers spent an hour and a half in ICU with someone who had multiple bullet wounds, and all he did was put his hand on the dog's head and just kept it there, and that was comforting. So they did a lot of visitations in ICU, a lot of visitations in the hospital. In the Family Assistance Center, that's where you find out, is the person that you know and love, are they alive or dead? imagine if your husband and children from California went to Nevada to go to the concert. Like, where's your car? Where's your phone? Where's your person? There are all kinds of things that have to be answered. Death notifications. Family Assistance Center. Those are the people who have to give that death notification. And so the dogs help to mediate all those various situations. And also, very, very important, they provide support to these responders, to these special victims advocates. The EMTs asked for the dogs to come and help them.
Assistance dogs also work with people who have PTSD.
I raised this beautiful yellow lab, and she was a lot of dog to raise because she's a super, super worker bee. She was a little bit of a pain because every time we turned around, if you didn't have your closet blocked off, she would run into the closet and bring out a pair of shoes. And you need these shoes? No? Run back in, get a different pair of shoes or whatever. Every time you turned around, she was doing something. But really a good, good girl. And she matured very slowly. She was almost 2.5. We're like, are you ever going to grow up? She met a veteran who had a combat injury and who was very self-isolated. Never went anywhere. And she loved him. He was in our Warrior Canine Connection class, where veterans learn to train the service dogs as part of their non-pharmaceutical therapy for PTSD, traumatic brain injury, mobility issues. Very, very powerful. And we have veterans from all different conflicts, from Vietnam to Afghanistan, and all in between, all different ages. And sure enough, they got placed together, and he sends us pictures now every month. He calls her my everything. He's out on the golf course with her. They're in the forest, in the snow, running around with other dogs and people. His life has totally changed and become a really full and rich life because this dog has made the bridge for him to return to civilian life in a really meaningful way. He sent us one picture. I love this picture. She was like exhausted in his arms. And he said, I finally wore her out today.
Now, assistance dogs are trained from puppyhood to be helpers and workers. But sometimes a rescue dog can even save your life. We're going to hear now from a woman whom I met at the dog park when I was sitting on the bench with the sign, Tell Me About Your Dog.
This is Jake, and he is an amazing dog. He has changed children's lives. He's a therapy dog. He also pretty much saved my life about 1.5 years ago. I was in the shower, and I simultaneously had a stroke and a heart attack. And I noticed I couldn't see my arm. I didn't know what was going on. And I finally fell, landed, the water streaming everywhere. And I couldn't talk. I couldn't walk. I couldn't call for help. And so I just lay there, trying to get up the courage and the energy to try to crawl. And meanwhile, he must have heard me fall, or they just have a sense. But he spent, I don't know how long, using his nose and his paws. And he eventually got the bathroom door open. And he lay down right beside me in the rushing water, helped his hand, and got it onto his collar. And he crawled with me all the way up to the front of the house where my husband was. But of course, my husband knew nothing because I couldn't call for help. And so they were able to call an ambulance, get me to the hospital. I was in intensive care for quite a while. I couldn't say my name. I couldn't swallow. This side of my body was not functioning. And I was in physical therapy and speech therapy and occupational therapy for about 3 months. And here I am, back. And, it was all in part because he was able to hear me and come to my rescue. So that was pretty awesome. He's a smart boy. So, yeah, I made a complete recovery, came back, and the whole time I was away, he was lying by the front door just waiting for me to come back. And he's just an amazing dog.
Okay. Dogs have become not only our companions and co-workers, but our best friends, our little babies, and we carry this to the point of absurdity with people dressing their dogs like ballerinas and Santa Claus and Elvis and innumerable other humiliating get-ups. If you want to go over the top, do a Google search on dog costumes. And so, while I guess this sounds like stating the obvious, it's actually important to remember that the mind of a dog is in many ways profoundly different from the human mind, even as they can be our best friends and are very much our mirrors. Clive Wynn is a professor of psychology at Arizona State University, and we talked about the origins of the scientific and psychological study of dogs, which, you guessed it, dates back to Ivan Petrovich Pavlov, as in Pavlov's dogs. Over a century ago, Pavlov found that natural reflexes like salivating when food is presented could be conditioned. So he'd give the dogs food and simultaneously present a sound so dogs would salivate when they heard the sound. Pavlov was one of a number of psychologists studying dogs.
Yeah, in the first half of the 20th century, psychologists, behavioral psychologists, studied dogs quite a bit. But generally speaking, they weren't really interested in the dogs for themselves. They were just studying behavior. And in that period in the history of psychology, there was a feeling that it didn't matter much which species you studied, that the processes of behavior would be common to all species. And so you just studied whatever was handy. And since Pavlov had started with dogs, dogs were a natural animal for people to study for a long time.
But in the second half of the 20th century, dogs just kind of went out of fashion and pretty much disappeared from scientific study. It wasn't until the late 1990s that dogs reappeared as a topic of science.
And this time, they reappeared very much as animals in their own right, very much as people were studying dogs because they were interested in dogs. And I think the question that really animated the scientists that reinitiated the study of dog psychology, the question that grabbed them was, what makes dogs so successful? Why do dogs live inside human homes as beloved companions, whereas most animals, you know, people don't let many different animals into their homes? I now believe that it is actually dogs' ability to capture our affections and to reciprocate our affections. It is the thing that makes dogs so successful.
I asked Wynn about the differences from a psychological perspective between dogs and wolves. How different can it be since they are genetically so similar?
Dogs and wolves are very, very closely related. Every single dog is descended from wolves. But as a psychologist, I can tell you that behaviorally, dogs and wolves are radically, radically different. For example, wolves live in packs. Now, people have different pictures in their minds when you talk about a pack, but a wolf pack is nothing more or less than a nuclear family. The alpha male and the alpha female, they're just mom and dad. The other members of the pack are the children. That's a wolf pack. Now, contrast that with dogs. Dogs don't have a family life. In dogs left to live as they will by their own devices, the father in a dog, quote unquote, family, he only does that absolute minimum which qualifies an individual to be a father. He does nothing more than that. The mother also only does the absolute minimum that qualifies an individual to be a mother. She carries the fetuses to term. She gives birth, nurses them for 8 weeks, and then she kicks them out. So you have this massive difference in family life. Wolves then go off and are apprenticed into the pack, and they hunt and kill and eat animals that are much bigger than they are. The vast majority of dogs are incapable of hunting, and even in the rare situations where a group of dogs do hunt, they usually cannot sustain their own population by hunting. Dogs that are not pets, which is the majority of the world's dogs are not pets, right? If there are a billion dogs on the surface of this planet, only a minority of them, maybe 250 million, maybe 300 million, live as pets in people's homes. The vast majority of the world's dogs are scavengers. So you have this massive difference in family life, massive difference in how dogs and wolves survive and thrive. And you also find that dogs are much more willing and ready to form strong emotional bonds with members of other species. We, because we are human beings, we think of dogs as beings that love people. But that's actually just a factor of our perspective on dogs. In reality, dogs can and do form warm emotional relationships with whatever kinds of animals they happen to be placed with when they're young. So farmers, some livestock farmers, use dogs to guard their livestock. And how do you do that? I went out and I visited some people who have a goat farm here in Arizona, and their goats are guarded by dogs. And the way you teach a dog to guard goats is you take the dog when it's a puppy and you put it among goats. And dogs readily form strong bonds with whatever kinds of things they meet when they are young. And that's just not true of wolves. It's not true of wild animals in general. Whereas in dogs, dogs are so slow to develop that the window of opportunity for them to learn what kinds of things might I make friends with as I grow up, that window of opportunity is much longer. And so they form relationships with many different species very easily.
So dogs bond with us, we bond with dogs, and usually it goes pretty well. But does it matter what kind of dog we have? People can get really fixated on dog breeds. There are Dachshund people and Rottweiler people and Poodle people and everything else. And we love what we perceive as their breed characteristics. But to what extent are those characteristics really distinct and quantifiable?
There are certain characteristic patterns of behavior that are unique to certain breeds or groups of breeds. But what I prefer to emphasize, because most of us are not getting terriers anymore to kill rats. And we're not getting pointer breeds of dog because we go hunting and we need a dog that points. Most of us are just looking for a good companion, a loving companion. And studies that have been done that assess across a broad range of dimensions the personalities of thousands of dogs from hundreds of different breeds, those studies actually most commonly find that what is striking is how similar breeds of dogs are. The differences in general personality characteristics between breeds are not that great. And meanwhile, there are always significant, substantial differences in personality, even within a breed. I try and de-emphasize breed. And when people come to me because they're looking for a dog, I encourage them to actually interview candidate dogs for the job of being their companion. A dog is not like a car, right? One Honda Accord is going to behave 99.9% identically to the next Honda Accord. But when it comes to living things, when it comes to dogs, we shouldn't adopt that kind of attitude. And yet people still do. When we're looking for a dog companion in our lives, we should first of all think about where would this dog fit into our lives? What kind of a life do you have? If you're a runner, it would make sense to find a dog who would like to run with you. If you're a swimmer, I don't know, you might want your dog to go swimming with you. I don't mind that my dog doesn't go swimming with me, but some people might. If you're a couch potato, and you should fess up to that if you are, then you should try and find a candidate dog who wants to hang out on the sofa and watch movies with you, right? Which is something I love doing with my dog, and I'm always upset if she doesn't want to watch television with me. So you should identify realistically what kind of openings your life offers, and then you should actually interview individual dogs and, as best you can, see whether they are able to fulfill that need in your life.
So how do you interview a dog? I mean, it's not like you can say, so, do you like taking long walks on the beach? Do you like to watch television? What are your favorite shows? How do you do that?
Favorite shows probably doesn't matter, actually. But there are a lot of wonderful dogs in shelters. I tend to try and encourage people to go looking in shelters. And the best shelters nowadays will let you take a dog home, maybe for a few hours, maybe for a weekend. And if that's an opportunity that a shelter offers, you should definitely avail yourself of that. But most people, we did a study of people looking for dogs at a shelter in Florida. This was before fostering had really caught on, and this particular shelter would not have let you take a dog home with you. All you could do was take a dog out of its kennel and play with it in the yard of the shelter. But still, that's enough of an opportunity to find out whether the dog likes to play frisbee, likes to play ball, likes to go running, rather would sit with you quietly. And yet, the average length of time that people spent interviewing a dog was just 8 minutes. Just 8 minutes. I mean, that really shocked me that people spend so little time interviewing a candidate dog for this role of companion in their lives. A role which, I mean, it can have massive impacts on how your life develops. If this dog is a good companion for you or a poor companion, that's a substantial change in your life, positive or negative. So I was astonished that people would only spend 8 minutes interviewing the candidate dog.
Although there are, I have to say, I mean, and you probably know this as well, there are those times when you go to a shelter or an adoption event or whatever, and you see a dog and it sees you, and suddenly there's this sense that you've met your soulmate. And this is something, I don't think you can really study this scientifically, but have you had that? Do you know that feeling of that kind of soulmate's meeting with a dog?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Much as I hate to contradict myself, I definitely am very aware of that feeling. I mean, it's like falling in love, right? I mean, a feeling that this individual is for you and that fate has just been waiting for this moment to put you together. I mean, I cannot deny that, much as it goes against what I was just saying. But I think even what I could say there to maintain some semblance of consistency is that even in that situation, it still makes sense to give yourself a chance to get to know that individual better before finally committing. Let's say it's still worth having a courtship before you marry, right? Even if you fall in love at first sight.
It's really striking how much all this sounds like the human dating scene.
People are very influenced by what a dog looks like. If you're really cute, you can get away with anything. And we found that with the dogs, the really physically attractive dogs, people didn't pay much attention to how they behaved, which I think was a mistake, because in the long run, the attraction of physical beauty wears off and it's the behavior that you're left with. And on the other hand, the less physically attractive dogs really had to watch how they behaved. And the stress of living in a shelter is not conducive to putting a dog on its best behavior. Dogs incarcerated in shelters for extended period of time tend to develop habits that potential adopters find unattractive, like barking a lot of the time, pacing up and down. But fortunately, we found some ways of improving dogs' behavior in shelters that improve their chances of getting adopted.
How did you do that?
All you need to do is to encourage everybody who comes into the kennel block, into the shelter building, to throw food treats into the kennels as they wander around. And if the dogs come to expect that when a person appears, there might be a food treat involved, that brings their behavior in general towards a pattern of behavior that visitors find more attractive.
There's also another really interesting thing that some shelters are doing. If you've ever adopted a dog from a shelter, you might have seen cards on their cages or titles on their website saying what breed they are. It turns out that these labels are notoriously inaccurate. Clive Wynn got a donation of 1,000 DNA tests that were used on shelter dogs.
We found that the vast majority of these breed identifications are wrong. They're just wild guesses, and yet they have a very powerful impact on how people make decisions about dogs. We did studies, and we found that people pay more attention to the breed label than they do to the dog actually in front of them.
What would you suggest? Like, how do you solve that problem?
Well, the simplest thing is just to tell shelters to give up wasting their time making inaccurate guesses. Take the breed labels off. This was actually done in Orlando, Florida, the major county shelter. They removed all the breed information, or misinformation really, from the kennel cards. And what we found was that there was a big jump in the adoption of breeds that were unattractive breed names. But actually, really interestingly, adoptions of all breeds went up if they did not have any breed information on the kennel at all.
Another quality that people are always looking for and talking about in dogs is dog intelligence. They'll talk about border collies. They'll say, oh, they're highly intelligent. What do we mean when we talk about intelligence in dogs?
I've actually met a border collie chaser who has been referred to as the world's smartest dog. Chaser knows the names of over 1,200 toys. You could put out a dozen of them, a random dozen. You could ask Chaser for one of them, and she'd go off and she'd bring it back. But for me, it's human intelligence that you're actually looking at there. The real genius in those dogs is the genius of the people that develop ways of training them. So my overall feeling is, and I'm hesitating and hedging because I don't want to upset anybody who feels that their dog is smart. There are smart dogs and there are fantastic things that dogs do. But I don't really think that dogs stand out for their intelligence.
What is it then that makes dogs stand out?
I think the remarkable thing about dogs is their capacity to form strong emotional connections to members of other species. We primarily see them forming these bonds with us, but if you have a young dog pup and you put it out where it will have the chance to interact with goats or with sheep or even with cats, if the cat will tolerate the dog, our dog has fallen in love with our cat. And that's what's really remarkable about dogs, this tremendously open program for building social bonds, for building strong emotional connections with members of other species. That's what's really, really striking about dogs.
There's about a million more things to say about dogs, about progress in veterinary care and spay-neuter programs, about dogs' many heroic accomplishments, about dogs in art and literature, about how to be a responsible dog owner, about dog shows and dog racing and dog fighting, the full range of beauty and joy and cruelty. But I think I'll just leave you with the wisdom of a young woman from the dog park.
I love dogs because they make you stay so present and really recognize subtleties. I feel like people are very focused on being people and we're not really, you know, ones to notice plants and nature and animals and the beings that are so much living their own lives. So it's kind of a challenge to have that cross-species recognition, but I think it's such an important one and very meaningful.
You've been listening to Thought Huddle. We're coming to you from Arizona State University. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte Domondi. You can find us on iTunes, on your podcast app, and at thoughthuddle.com. Thanks to Nikai Salcido and Zaylee Pollan for production assistance on this podcast, and to Ross Hamlin for the music. And thanks to you for listening.